Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch, and welcome to the Future Herd. If Canada is serious about becoming a global agri-food powerhouse, it will be because of leaders like Dana McCauley. Dana is one of the most experienced and generous innovation leaders in this country's food sector. Trained as a chef, shaped by food media, battle-tested inside manufacturing, and now operating at the national level of commercialization and ecosystem development, she has seen the food system from plate to plant to policy. But what makes her exceptional isn't simply that breadth, it's her catalytic energy. Dana has a rare ability to move knowledge across boundaries, translating between entrepreneurs and executives, researchers and manufacturers, visionaries and operators. She doesn't hoard insight, she distributes it generously. And in a sector as fragmented as agri-food, that habit of sharing may be more powerful than any single innovation. In this conversation, we explore her journey from kitchens to corporate leadership to national food innovation strategy. We unpack what commercialization really demands, why culture inside organizations matters as much as technology, and what Canada must get right if we want our food companies not just to start, but to scale. If you care about the future competitiveness, resilience, and intelligence of Canada's food system, you'll want to listen closely. How did you get to where you are now, professionally, in terms of your focus and your expertise? Because I think that sets up our focus on the future.
So my personal professional story is that can be summed up by saying I've just gotten further away from people's mouths. I started out with chef's training and worked in fine dining and decided that was really hard. And fortunately, I had a university background that set me up to work in magazines and that kind of thing. So I went from being like right there where I could see the people eating the food I had touched to then being a step further away, writing the recipes that people would make at home. Then I left doing that full time, become a freelancer, started writing things like, you know, a newsletter called Top Line Trends. And that got me inbound requests from businesses, to be perfectly honest. I didn't realize I was well suited to work in the food sector other than as, you know, a service provider of either words or food. And businesses came to me and said, hey, this is really cool what you're talking about. You could help our business. And I was like, can I? So that led to a number of years where I helped businesses to develop recipe campaigns and new products. And I ended up with a test kitchen and staff and all that kind of stuff. Eventually sold that to one of my employees. Then I went to work for a food manufacturer who had been one of my clients. They wanted to have a complete sort of cultural change in their organization and thought I could help with that. And that, you know, led to about 10 years working as an executive in frozen food companies. And then when that all sort of came to its sort of natural end, I was approached by the city of Toronto to be on the board of something called Food Starter. And I said, well, who's going to run the place? Who would be, you know, who am I going to be managing and making sure that they don't take risks? And they didn't have anybody. So I said, well, I could help you for a year. I could help get it up and running. This is kind of a hard thing and you'll have a hard time finding somebody who can do it. And they thought that was a good idea. And 2.5 years later, I was still there. And I was recruited to go to the University of Guelph to help their agricultural researchers and food researchers to commercialize their IP, to understand, you know, the elasticity of what they had discovered. And that was a super cool thing. And little did I know, I had this 360-degree experience from all of those different jobs that set me up to come here to CFIN and a network that unites all of those different folks.
I do want to spend some time today talking about that network and the kind of crucial role it already plays, will play in terms of the future of our ag food system. But what I love about your story is it is a kind of unique leadership path that not everyone has the opportunities you've had, to your point, to get that 360-degree view, but also to acquire the knowledge that you've been able to in terms of the perspectives and the roles and the different aspects of the industry that you've been involved in. But there's one piece I want to tease out, which is, why do you think that trends are both still valuable today, but the kind of thing that is unusually scarce? Like, you would think that trends are something that are accessible, that anyone can pay attention to. And yet it feels as if it is a kind of unique characteristic, not just that you yourself possess, but that remains in demand. That is something that people are still really desiring to know. So I'd love it if you'd take a moment just to kind of reflect on the role that it plays within the industry.
I think it's actually become harder to track trends and to feel like you have a grasp on what's happening external to your own little world. When I first started out, and I was always working in food trends, to be clear, so this might not track against other type of trends, but it was pretty simple. All I really had to do was read all of the trade magazines, go to a few trade shows, and hang out with my chef friends and see what was exciting them. And I could distill that quite simply into fairly easy to verify, you know, insights that would track to growth, because that was the pattern. But with the rise of social media and influencer culture and algorithms that feed people more of what they've already been looking for, it's way, way harder to see where something's going to bubble up and what it might, you know, might do as far as impact on the food business goes. Like the same TikTok influencer who, you know, uses cucumbers today and causes a sellout at the farmer's market could put out a video tomorrow that doesn't hit, right? So it's a very different pattern. And I think that's one of the reasons people continue to ask for guidance, is because what I, you know, figured out fairly early on was quite easy to duplicate once you knew what I was doing. Now it's, you know, you have to dig into a lot more data, and you have to really, it's hard to do in on your own individually, because the algorithm almost prevents you from doing it. You have to kind of work in a team and see what other people are also seeing, and take a more of a heat map approach.
Well, and I think indirectly that partly speaks to the value of the Canadian Food Innovation Network, in that it is no longer possible to be that sole actor, that even the heroic entrepreneur still needs a community of fellows, a community of people engaged with the same energy, engaged with the same momentum. So I'd love for you to kind of connect that, both the need to kind of pay attention to changing market conditions, to identify opportunities, and the need to do so in a network. Your journey almost seems self-evident in reverse, but how has it been for you to foster this kind of genuine collaboration, to encourage people to see the value in a network, but at the same time kind of help build it from the ground up?
Yeah, I have to say that it's been surprising and gratifying, and in some ways just, yeah, a real amazing learning experience, because it's one thing to put stuff out there, and you and I both have experience, you know, being in the broadcast world, TV and radio, and we know that, you know, having an opinion and a point of view can be a wonderful way to start conversations and to create some inbound. But when you're creating something like Yodel, which is Stephen's, you know, virtual online portal, it can't be one-sided, right? It's not a newspaper. It's designed for interaction. And it's in that interaction where the really interesting stuff pops up, and where you see these interprovincial opportunities, and where you discover these unlikely intersections. But that only happens if others will participate. And that was the big risk with creating a virtual element to our network, was that people would either, one, not like it, two, come and just, you know, loiter and take. But amazingly, people in the food sector who have every, you know, justifiable right to tend towards, you know, hoarding their trade secrets and keeping their information to themselves for competitive reasons, they aren't. They're really out there helping each other. And it's not just people who are in non-competitive, you know, like a baker talking to, you know, somebody who makes soup. It's actually soup people talking to soup people sometimes. And that's really awesome to see. It kind of renews your faith in humanity, to be perfectly honest.
Well, and it's the depth and substance of Yodel that I found really quite remarkable. And on the one hand, I see this as an avid learner, that part of my interest in the ag food sector is to learn as much of it as I can. But to your point, some of the industry intelligence, some of the market intelligence that's shared just amongst people trying to source partners or try to find a packaging, it speaks to me that we're seeing a glimpse of the future of the sector. That in Yodel, we're getting a glimpse of the combination of collaboration, transparency, and market. I'd love for you to kind of extrapolate in the kind of blue sky sense where you think that could go. That as Yodel continues to grow, as more people kind of recognize the inherent value that it offers, you know, this gets to our point about the future, that I think, you know, that William Gibson line of the future's already here, it's just not, you know, evenly distributed. You are experiencing part of that future. So I'd love for you to share with our listeners, you know, where you think it's headed.
Well, it's interesting. I love William Gibson, by the way. And another day, I'll tell you a story about how I embarrassed myself in front of him one time. But another author I love is Ian McEwan. And he and Machines Like Me, there was a great line, which I probably won't get perfect, but there was a line about, you know, how our shiny new toys and innovations the next day, you know, seem ordinary. And that's, of course, always true of innovation. You know, the day you got electricity back in the day was probably transformative. And 2 weeks later, you're probably complaining that the light wasn't in the right part of the room. But I have to caution myself from doing that when I think about Yodel, because we have accomplished a lot. We said we would have 1,500 people on Yodel by, you know, September 2025. And as of September 2025, we probably had about 7,000. And today, now in December 2025, we have 8,000. And we predict that we'll have 20,000 users in the next 5 years. So it's, you know, far exceeded what we expected it to be. And yet to me, it seems very ordinary and quite frustrating that we aren't already at 20,000. But what's cool about what I'm seeing happening here is that a lot of the things, like I said, like people hoarding their trade secrets, et cetera, that we, you know, had as assumptions are not true. And we are seeing that this very fragmented sector is very willing to work together and eager to help one another. And I think if we go from right now, Yodel is a lot of discussions, and there's some tools. There's a funding finder, there's a resource finder, which is evolving and becoming better by the day. But there's going to be this amazing opportunity to use a virtual space, I think, to create pathways where anybody who is at any point in an innovation cycle to come in and, you know, kind of like Harry Potter's sorting hat, you know, just type in what they're trying to do. And I think we can build the structures that can scan through all of the projects that we've done as CFIN and probably case studies from universities, et cetera, and create pathways that can just help somebody in the moment to see what every other person who has been recorded doing the same type of journey, what they did, and direct them to all kinds of different resources and help them to, you know, get things that they would otherwise take months and months and months to find and have to have deep relationships to even get to the right people, to just have that at their fingertips. And when that happens, innovation is going to be accessible to so many more people. It's just going to really, you know, instead of failing forward to the degree that people who came before them had to fail forward, they're going to succeed much, much more frequently. So I'm pretty excited about how we might be able to accelerate the pace of innovation in the future.
Well, and I think that also evokes a powerful point about collaboration, that collaboration is this buzzword you hear a lot in the sector. But you just evoke the idea that not only do we not have to repeat the mistakes that others have made, it's almost as if we could imagine a commercial equivalent to the idea of standing on the shoulders of giants.
100%.
That we don't have to keep asking companies to go through the same hurdles. but create a network, create an infrastructure that allows them to benefit from each other's success. How do you imagine that scaling up? How do you imagine that, you know, to your point, not just in terms of Yodel's growth, but the sector's growth as a whole?
Well, I think human nature might be the biggest hurdle we'll have, because, of course, we all love to feel like we, you know, as Frank Sinatra, it's a, you know, I did it my way. And there's a certain bit of arrogance that I think many entrepreneurs need to succeed. So some of it will depend on people's willingness to learn from others and to, you know, be creative from a base, a solid base. It's like most movements, most new things, there's a few early adopters and they start talking about it. And then a couple of other people, and those are the most important ones, come in, validate that what those folks said is true. And then it becomes ubiquitous, right? It doesn't happen overnight. And that's why I say quite frequently in my conversations, particularly with government partners, that we need this culture change in the Canadian food sector, because a lot of people don't realize that most of the food companies in Canada are small, like 91% of the in Canada who are putting the food that you, you know, buy at the grocery store and at restaurants, you know, out there for you, have fewer than 100 employees. And most of them have, you know, fewer than 50 employees. So these are not big companies. So if we have this culture change, if we get, you know, 25% of them adopting, you know, new ways to be productive and new ways to be innovative, and then we can grow that to 30, 40, 50, we can really have an outsized effect, because we're not talking about, you know, these massive big companies that, because of documentaries and because of books, you know, like Food Inc. and et cetera, I think Canadians don't necessarily realize that Canada's food business isn't really dominated by the multinationals and these monolithic companies that we maybe think they are. So when we remember that the people who are running these great businesses, putting these fantastic products onto the shelves, are actually our neighbors, the empathy that we as consumers get, I think, is different. And I think then we understand what the challenges are in a different way, because it's not getting into the boardrooms of publicly traded companies and getting them to buy in. It's getting really busy, very passionate, hardworking folks to just slow down for a second, say, oh yeah, I could work a little bit smarter than I'm working today.
Well, it kind of evokes the concept of the chef and the chef as leader, because on the one hand, you know, chefs are leaders within our communities. And to your point, they are often small businesses that are hardworking, that are constantly grinding. But there is an ethic of sharing, correct me if I'm wrong, within that identity. And when you talk about cultural change, what I was also hearing is a new kind of leadership. And a new kind of leadership that focuses on sharing, that focuses on empowerment, that, to your point, recognizes that Canada's food system is kind of unique in terms of our small players. So I would love, again, this may be something you take for granted, but I would love for you to kind of unpack your model of leadership and the way in which, to your point, it's not about trade secrets. It's not about, you know, the kind of ego-driven, I did it my way. It's very much about how do we learn from each other so that we can adapt to a very tumultuous and volatile marketplace.
I think you picked up on something that you're right. I probably haven't thought about very consciously before, but I think it might actually be, you know, maybe one of the elements of my ability to do some of the things I've done. The fact that I did start in a chef environment and not a food manufacturing environment, because you very rightly point out that for chefs, it is all about sharing. It's about community. It's relationships with the farmer, relationships with your customer. But, you know, my husband owned a restaurant in Yorkville, you know, one of the fanciest neighborhoods in Canada, you know, with very big name chefs. And they would routinely, if somebody, you know, at 8 o'clock on a Friday night had run out of lamb, you'd have a dishwasher running from one restaurant to another, taking like it was not unusual, right, for that kind of thing to happen, because they recognize that in a neighborhood like Yorkville, having lots of good restaurants means that you have lots of customers for everybody, right? And they work together. But in food manufacturing, that is quite different. I worked at one food manufacturing company that still exists, so I won't name them. And I was so surprised. I was vice president of marketing and innovation. And we had several tractor trailer loads full of old equipment. And I was like, you know, looking at our financials in one of our board meetings. And I was like, or senior management meetings rather. And I was like, well, why are we spending this many thousands of dollars? Let's just sell that equipment. And the CEO was like, no, we can't sell that equipment. It's then people can make what we're making exactly the same way. And I'm like, okay, well, fine. But, you know, that's a cost we don't need. So very different approaches. And I do think that the hospitality part of the food business and probably the farming part of the food business are very much rooted in community and everybody working together and sharing and that those are good lessons for folks down into the food manufacturing space to learn from, because we keep quoting different books and songs and stuff and cliches today, but it literally does take a village. In Canada, we're such a geographically big country that really if we think about shortening supply chains and making a resilient local economies to make a resilient national economy, there is room for there to be, you know, an Ontario company that is fantastic at the same thing that a Vancouver company or a BC company is fantastic at as well. And they can work together to, you know, obviously within reasonable limits.
Well, and you also, I think, indirectly just connected some dots for me there in terms of young people and leadership, because the other thing that both farming and the food service industry kind of have in common is it's the easiest way that young people get into the industry.
Number one,
whether it's serving
for young people is restaurants. Yeah,
exactly. And what's fascinating about your story is it gives this vision of the future in which we have not just upward mobility, but cross-sectoral mobility. Because I think one thing you and I both hold quite deeply is the belief that we need more young people in positions of power. We need more young people feeling as if they have a stake in this system. Could you speculate or imagine on how we make those links so that those young people who are serving tables can imagine a future anywhere within the sector as long as they're willing to learn and adapt?
I think that, you know, when I look at people under 30 right now, which I guess would be Gen Zs and Alphas, the few that I have frequent contact with seem to have a very different mindset than I had at that age. You know, at 29, had my own business. I was married to someone who had their own business. We couldn't afford it then, but we knew we were going to be able to buy a house and we were going to, you know, have nice things and all that stuff. Young people right now feel like they have a lot of limitations. I don't hear them talking about being able to own homes and do a lot of the aspirational things that felt like almost a right that I assumed that I if I worked hard, that I would just get those things. But I think we have to start with helping them to feel empowered to hope and dream and to aspire. I think that's a societal issue right now. But then when it comes to the food sector, so many of people in those cohorts are, you know, they're so well educated and they've been exposed to so much world information, and they've grown up watching people like Greta Thunberg, you know, kind of stand in her power and own an issue and be effective. So they're quite purpose driven. And that's what's so wonderful about the food business is you can make a living and accomplish a lot of those historical milestones, but you also can do a lot of really good work, really, you know, good stuff for your community while having a really great business. And so many of the skills that people are coming out of college and university with are transferable to the food sector. But young people don't know that. They don't see it. We aren't telling them that, hey, your data science degree or your math degree is useful because we're all creating and using a lot of data. Machine learning is one of the most powerful tools for helping food companies to become more productive, and it's amazing.
And that's the paradox, I think, that on the one hand, we see the potential in young people, but on the other hand, they may not have the vision that our age and wisdom affords us. I think on the one hand, that is the leadership role we can play as aging or almost aging professionals, that we can help them see that vision. But let me ask you this. What excites you about the future that you could share or frame, to your point, as an invitation for young people to get more involved in this sector, to really see that there are no limits outside of their imagination?
And I'd say for the young people who have been reared on sci-fi and video games that include sort of magical realism and future, the William Gibson readers that are that it's going to, like, we're in the golden age of food science right now. I say that all the time. And it is really exciting. If you think about what is possible right now using cellular agriculture and cultivated, you know, types of models to make foods using, well, even air, you know, if you think about what we can do with precision fermentation and all of these other technologies, it is feasible that in a couple of decades, maybe three, that if you were a chef, you could say to a group of food scientists, you could say, I'd like you to create a pork chop for me that has the flavor of Dutch tulip-fed pork and the fatty unctuousness of Iberico pork. And that literally will be possible. We have companies already here in Canada, like Liven, who are working on the collagen piece of that pork chop. We have companies like Genuine Taste, who are working on the fat. We have companies like Ardra, who are working on, you know, the duplicating the juiciness and the color that, you know, that the animal's blood brings to a piece of meat. And of course, you can imagine also that we could have local chocolate, local coffee, using the same types of methods. So being part of that is super, super exciting. And I hope I live to see it, because I think that'll be so cool. Because right now, every chef gets a very similar pork chop. It's really just the technique that they use to prepare it that differentiates them. Can you imagine that? You have your own pork chop? I mean, that's pretty cool. And then, you know, and as I said, there's just so many opportunities to be part of businesses that will just help Canada to be more sovereign, more resilient, maybe doing much less, you know, sort of flashy stuff than I just described. But there really is a generational opportunity to create a different, much more, I don't know, grown-up version of Canada. It's the right time to, and we've got the right resources to really change the country and help it to grow up and kind of stand on its own two feet. It's exciting.
I concur fully. I really feel that we are in such a unique leadership opportunity that some of the dreams, whether sci-fi or just in terms of a better society that you and I growing up, you know, our culture has had, we're at a moment where we could actually see them being implemented. But to your point, we need young people as our partners. And I always love chatting with you and listening to you, because you always help my vocabulary. And in this case, once we're done, I'm going to go look up precision fermentation as, again, a concept that has just completely blown my mind. Is there any final thoughts, any kind of issues that you think we as a society, we as keeners within the food ag sector should be keeping an eye on? Because again, that's what I love about picking your brain is you are at this unique intersection where you're seeing so many of the layers of innovation and change happening in the system. Just some of the breadcrumbs blow my mind for the future consideration. What are some things we should be keeping our eyes on?
Well, first off, thank you so much. You've made my day. I feel, you know, very, very, very seen and appreciated. But I think what we have to do is we all have to commit to getting in front of topics. So precision fermentation, you just mentioned that is something you're going to look up. Thank you. We need to get in front of science messaging that could be scary or could be something that other groups do not want to succeed because it would threaten something that they already do, you know, economically. We've seen Buttergate. We saw, you know, the whole GMO debate. There's this whole thing about seed oils right now. And unfortunately, when you start to get messaging going out there in this day and age, it was always hard, but it's even more difficult for people to really get to the real information, the actual scientific, you know, documented information that helps them to make the right choices for themselves. That's really going to be super important for us to keep an open mind, ask questions, and for us, hopefully, to help train these large language model, you know, apps like Gemini, ChatGPT, et cetera, to sort through the info in a way that does deliver the actual verified truth as opposed to opinion. And that's going to be a huge issue for us going forward, because it's been and it just kind of continues to rear its ugly head. So somehow getting in front of the truth and making sure people feel like they're making choices that are, you know, healthy for themselves, and knowing why they're making the right choice, that's super important.
Thank you, Dana. Brilliant as always. And I suspect we'll have the privilege of speaking with you again in the future.
Anytime, Jesse. Your questions are great. And I think we could talk for hours. So thank you so much. I appreciate this.
That was Dana McCauley. What makes this conversation important isn't just Dana's career trajectory. It's what her trajectory reveals about Canada's agri-food future. Innovation doesn't emerge from isolated brilliance. It requires connective tissue. It requires mentorship. It requires people who understand both how food is made and how businesses survive. Dana represents a generation of leaders who bridge worlds, culinary and corporate, entrepreneurial and institutional. And that bridge building may be one of our most underappreciated national strengths. If Canada is going to compete globally in food, we'll need more than just good ideas. We'll need systems that help those ideas mature, scale, and endure. Leaders who circulate knowledge rather than centralize it, and networks that lower the cost of learning. At the Future Herd, we believe these conversations are part of that infrastructure. So if this episode sparks something for you, whether you're a founder, a processor, a researcher, a policymaker, or like me, just a farmer doing their chores, well, please share this episode. Because ecosystems grow when insight moves. The future of food in Canada won't be built by accident. It will be built by people willing to share what they know and willing to build together. I'm Jesse Hirsch. We'll see you next time in the Future Herd.
There's a tale of a Pioneer with a heart on the blow.